tell you, Uncle Jamie, if I thought shame would help, I wouldn't have scrupled to blush.
He looked so apologetically hangdog that I couldn't help laughing. Jamie turned, hearing me, and his scowl faded slightly.
"He's not a bit of help, Sassenach," he said. "You've the Latin, have you not? Being a physician, you must. Perhaps I should leave his Latin schooling to you, eh?"
I shook my head. While it was more or less true that I could read Latin, badly and laboriously, I didn't fancy trying to cram the ragbag remnants of my education into Ian's head. "All I remember is Ama Verumque Cano." I glanced at Ian and translated, grinning, "My arm got bit off by a dog." Ian burst into giggles, and Jamie gave me a look of profound disillusion. He sighed and ran a hand through his hair. While Jamie and Ian didn't resemble each other in any physical respect beyond height, both had thick hair and the habit of running a hand through it when agitated or thoughtful. It looked to have been a stressful lesson. Both of them looked as though they'd been pulled backward through a hedgerow. Jamie smiled wryly at me, then turned back to Ian, shaking his head.
"Ah, well, I'm sorry to bark at you, Ian, truly. But you've a fine mind, and I shouldn't have liked to see you waste it. God, man, at your age I was in Paris, already starting to study at the university."
Ian stood looking down into the water that swirled past the side of the ship in smooth brown riffles. His hands rested on the rail, big hands, broad-backed and brown by the sun.
"Aye," he said, "and at my age, my own father was in France too, fighting."
I was a bit startled to hear this. I had known that the elder Ian had soldiered in France for a time, but not that he had gone so early for a soldier, nor stayed so long. Young Ian was just 15. The elder Ian had served as a foreign mercenary from that age then until the age of 22, when a cannon blast had left him with a leg so badly shattered by grape shot that it had been amputated just below the knee, and he had come home for good. Jamie looked at his nephew for a moment, frowning slightly. Then he came to stand beside Ian, leaning backward, hands on the rail to balance himself.
"I ken that, aye," Jamie said quietly, "for I followed him 4 years later when I was outlawed."
Ian looked up at that, startled.
"You were together there in France?"
There was a slight breeze caused by our movement, but it was still a hot day. Perhaps the temperature decided him that it was better to let the subject of higher learning drop for a moment. For Jamie nodded, lifting the thick tail of his hair to cool his neck.
"In Flanders, for more than a year, before Ian was wounded and sent home. We fought with a regiment of Scots mercenaries then, under Fergus MacLeodus."
Ian's eyes were alight with interest.
"Is that where Fergus, our Fergus, got his name then?"
His uncle smiled.
"Aye, I named him for MacLeodus, a bonny man and a great soldier forby. He thought weel of Ian. Did your dad never speak to you of him?"
Ian shook his head, his brow slightly clouded.
"He's never said a thing to me. I kent he'd lost his leg fighting in France. Mam told me that when I asked, but he wouldn't say a word about it himself."
With Dr. Rawlings's description of amputation vivid in my mind, I thought it likely that the elder Ian hadn't wanted to recall the occasion. Jamie shrugged, plucking the sweat-damp shirt away from his chest.
"Aye, well, I suppose he meant to put that time behind him once he'd come home and settled at Lallybroch, and then..."
He hesitated, but Ian was insistent.
"And then what, Uncle Jamie?"
Jamie glanced at his nephew, and one side of his mouth curled up.
"Well, I think he didn't want to tell too many tales of war and fighting, lest you lads get thinking on it and set yourselves to go for soldiers too. He and your mother will have wanted better for you, aye?"
I thought the elder Ian had been wise. It was clear from the look on his face that the younger Ian couldn't think of a much more exciting prospect than war and fighting.
"That will have been my mam's doing," Ian said with an air of disgust. She'd have me wrapped in wool and tied to her apron strings, did I let her?
Jamie grinned.
Oh, letter, is it? And you think she'd wrap you in wool and smother you with kisses if you were home this minute?
Ian dropped the pose of disdain.
Well, no, he admitted. I think she'd skelp me raw.
Jamie laughed.
You know a bit about women, Ian, if not as much as you think.
Ian glanced sceptically from his uncle to me and back.
And you'll ken all about them, I suppose, uncle.
I raised one eyebrow, inviting an answer to this, but Jamie merely laughed.
It's a wise man who kens the limits of his knowledge, Ian.
He bent and kissed my damp forehead, then turned back to his nephew, adding,
Though I could wish your own limits went a bit further.
Ian shrugged, looking bored.
I didn't mean to set up for a gentleman, he said. After all, young Jamie and Michael dinna read Greek. They do well enough.
Jamie rubbed his nose, considering his nephew thoughtfully.
Young Jamie has Lallybroch, and wee Michael does well wi' Jared in Paris. They'll be settled. We did as best we might for the two of them, but there was precious little money to pay for travel or schooling when they came to manhood. There wasn't much choice for them, aye?
He pushed himself off the rail and stood upright.
But your parents dinna want that for you, Ian, if better might be managed. They'll have you grow to be a man of learning and influence, than your usual, perhaps.
It was a Gaelic expression I had heard before, literally, a man of worth. It was a term for taxmen and lairds, the men of property and followers who ranked only below chieftains in the Highland clans. Such a man as Jamie himself had been before the Rising, but not now.
Mm-hmm. And did ye do as your parents wanted for ye then, Uncle Jamie?
Ian looked blandly at his uncle with only a wary twitch of the eye to show he knew he was treading on shaky ground. Jamie had meant to be Dunya Yuzo, indeed. Lallybroch had been his by right. It was only in an effort to save the property from confiscation by the Crown that he had made it over legally to young Jamie instead. Jamie stared at him for a moment, then rubbed a knuckle across his upper lip before replying.
"I did see you'd a fine mind, no?" he answered dryly. "Though, since you ask, I was raised to do two things, Ian. To mind my land and people, and to care for my family. I've done those two things as best I might, and I shall go on doing them as best I can."
Young Ian had the grace to look abashed at this.
I didn't mean, he mumbled, looking at his feet. Dinna fash, laddie,
Jamie interrupted, clapping him on the shoulder. He grinned wryly at his nephew.
You'll amount to something for your mother's sake, if it kills us both. And now I think it will be my turn at the pole.
He glanced forward to where Troclus's shoulders gleamed like oily copper, snake muscle with long labour. Jamie untied his breeches. Unlike the other men, he wouldn't take off his shirt for polling, but stripped his breeks for coolness and worked with his shirt knotted between his thighs in the Highland style, and nodded to Ian.
You think about it, laddie. Youngest son or no, your life's not meant to be wasted.
He smiled at me then with a sudden heart-stopping brilliance and handed me his shed breeks. Then, still holding my hand in his, he stood upright and, hand over heart, declaimed,
"O moa mas, I love a lass, as cedar tall and slender. Sweet cowslip's grace is her nominative case, and she's o' the feminine gender."
He nodded graciously to Ian, who had dissolved in giggles, and lifted my hand to his lips, blue eyes aslant with mischief.
"Can I decline a nymph so divine, her voice like a flute as dulcis? Her oculus bright, her manus white, and soft when I tattoo her pulses. Oh, how bella my puella, I'll kiss in secula seculorum. And if I've luck, sir, she's my uxor. O dies benedictorum."
He made a courtly leg to me, blinked solemnly in his version of a wink, and strode off in his shirt. Chapter 9. Two-thirds of a ghost. The surface of the river gleamed like oil, the water moving gently past without a ripple. There was a single lantern hung from the starboard bow. Sitting on a low stool perched on the forward deck, I could see the light below, not so much reflected in the water as trapped under it, moving slowly side by side with the boat. The moon was a faint sickle, making its feeble sweep through the treetops. Beyond the thick trees that lined the river, the ground fell away in broad sweeps of darkness over the rice plantations and tobacco fields. The heat of the day was sucked down into the earth, glowing with unseen energy beneath the surface of the soil, the rich, fertile flatlands simmering in black heat behind the screen of pines and sweet gum trees, working the alchemy of water and trapped sun. To move at all was to break a sweat. The air was tangible, each tiny ripple of warmth a caress against my face and arms. There was a soft rustle in the dark behind me, and I reached up a hand, not turning to look. Jamie's big hand closed gently over mine, squeezed, and let go. Even that brief touch left my fingers damp with perspiration. He eased himself down next to me with a sigh, plucking at the collar of his shirt. "I dinna think I've breathed air since we left Georgia," he said. "Every time I take a breath, I think I'll maybe drown." I laughed, feeling a trickle of sweat snake down between my breasts. "It will be cooler in Cross Creek. Everyone says so." I took a deep breath myself, just to prove I could. "Doesn't it smell wonderful, though?" The darkness released all the pungent green scents of the trees and plants along the water's edge, mingling with the damp mud of the river bank and the scent of sun-warmed wood from the deck of the boat. "You'd have made a good dog, Sassenach." He leaned back against the wall of the cabin with a sigh. "It's no wonder yon beast admires you so." The click of toenails on deck boards announced the arrival of Rollo, who advanced cautiously toward the rail, stopped a careful foot short of it, and lowered himself gingerly to the deck. He laid his nose on his paws and sighed deeply. Rollo disapproved almost as strongly of boats as Jamie did. "Hello there," I said. I extended a hand for him to sniff, and he politely condescended to let me scratch his ears. "And where's your master, eh?"
"In the cabin, being taught new ways to cheat at cards," Jamie said wryly. "God kens best what will happen to the lad. If he's not shot or knocked on the head in some tavern, he'll likely come home wi' an ostrich he's won at faro next."
"Surely they haven't either ostriches or faro games up in the mountains. If there aren't any towns to speak of, surely there aren't many taverns either."
"Well, I shouldn't have think so," he admitted. "But if a man's bound to go to the devil, he'll find a way to do it, no matter where you set him down."
"I'm sure Ian isn't going to the devil," I replied soothingly. "He's a fine boy."
"He's a man," Jamie corrected.
He cocked an ear toward the cabin where I could hear muffled laughter and the occasional comfortable obscenity.
"A damn young one, though, and fat-headed with it."
He looked at me, a rueful smile visible in the lantern light.
"If he were a wee lad yet, I could keep some rein on him. As it is,"
he shrugged,
"he's old enough to mind his own business, and he'll not thank me for sticking my nose in."
"He always listens to you," I protested.
"Wait till I tell him something he doesn't want to hear."
He leaned his head against the wall, closing his eyes. Sweat gleamed across the high cheekbones, and a small trickle ran down the side of his neck. I put out a finger and delicately flicked the tiny drop away before it further dampened his shirt.
"You've been telling him for 2 months that he has to go home to Scotland. He doesn't want to hear that, I don't think."
Jamie opened one eye and surveyed me cynically.
"Is he in Scotland?"
"Well..."
"Mm-hmm,"
he said, and closed the eye again. I sat quietly for a bit, blotting the perspiration off my face with a fold of my skirt. The river had narrowed here. The near bank was no more than 10 feet away. I caught a rustle of movement among the shrubs, and a pair of eyes gleamed briefly red with reflected light from our lantern.
Rollo lifted his head with a sudden low woof, ears pricked to attention.
Jamie opened his eyes and glanced at the bank, then sat up abruptly.
"Christ, that's the biggest rat I've ever seen."
I laughed. "It's not a rat. It's a possum. See the babies on her back." Jamie and Rollo regarded the possum with identical looks of calculation, assessing its plumpness and possible speed. Four small possums stared solemnly back, pointed noses twitching over their mother's humped, indifferent back. Obviously thinking the boat no threat, the mother possum finished lapping water, turned, and trundled slowly into the brush, the tip of her naked, thick pink tail disappearing as the lantern light faded. The two hunters let out identical sighs and relaxed again.
"Myers did see as they're fine eating," Jamie remarked wistfully.
With a small sigh of my own, I groped in the pocket of my gown and handed him a cloth bag.
"What's this?"
He peered interestedly into the bag, then poured the small lumpy brown objects out into the palm of his hand.
"Roasted peanuts," I said. "They grow underground hereabouts. I found a farmer selling them for hog food and had the in-wife roast some for me. You take off the shells before you eat them."
I grinned at him, enjoying the novel sensation of, for once, knowing more about our surroundings than he did. He gave me a mildly dirty look and crushed a shell between thumb and forefinger, yielding three nuts.
"I'm ignorant, Sassenach," he said. "Not a fool. There's a difference, eh?"
He put a peanut in his mouth and bit down gingerly. His sceptical look changed to one of pleased surprise, and he chewed with increasing enthusiasm, tossing the other nuts into his mouth.
"Like them?"
I smiled, enjoying his pleasure. "I'll make you peanut butter for your bread once we're settled, and I have my new mortar unpacked." He smiled back and swallowed before cracking another nut.
"I will see that if it's a swampish place, at least it's fine soil. I've never seen so many things grow so easily."
He tossed another nut into his mouth.
"I've been thinking, Sassenach," he said,
looking down into the palm of his hand.
"What would you think of maybe settling here?"
The question wasn't entirely unexpected. I had seen him eyeing the black fields and lush crops with a farmer's glittering eye, and caught his wistful expression when he admired the governor's horses. We couldn't go back to Scotland immediately, in any case. Young Ian, yes, but not Jamie or me, owing to certain complications, not the least of these being a complication by the name of Lyra Mackenzie.
"I don't know," I said slowly. "Indians and wild animals quite aside." "Oh, well," he interrupted, mildly embarrassed. "Myers told me that they were no difficulty at all, and you keep clear of the mountains."
I forbore from pointing out that the governor's offer would take us into the precincts of precisely those mountains.
"Yes, but you do remember what I told you, don't you? About the revolution? This is 1767. And you heard the conversation at the governor's table. 9 years, Jamie, and all hell breaks loose."
We had both lived through war, and neither of us took the thought lightly. I laid a hand on his arm, forcing him to look at me. "I was right, you know, before." I had known what would happen at Culloden, and had told him the fate of Charles Stuart and his men. And neither my knowing nor his had been enough to save us. 20 aching years of separation, and the ghost of a daughter he would never see lay behind that knowing. He nodded slowly and lifted a hand to touch my cheek. The soft glow of the small lantern overhead attracted clouds of tiny gnats. They swirled suddenly, disturbed by his movement.
"Aye, you were," he said softly. "But then we thought we must change things, or try at the least. But here..."
He turned, waving an arm at the vast land that lay unseen beyond the trees.
"I shouldn't think it my business," he said simply, "either to help or to hinder much."
I waved the gnats away from my face.
It might be our business, if we lived here.
He rubbed a finger below his lower lip, thinking. His beard was sprouting. A glimmer of red stubble sparked with silver in the lantern light.
He was a big man, handsome and strong, in the prime of his life, but no longer a young one, and I realized that with sudden gratitude.
Highland men were bred to fight. Highland boys became men when they could lift their swords and go to battle. Jamie had never been reckless, but he had been a warrior and a soldier most of his life. As a young man in his 20s, nothing could have kept him from a fight, whether it was his own or not. Now, in his 40s, sense might temper passion. Or at least I hoped so. And it was true, beyond this aunt whom he didn't know, he had no family here, no ties that might compel involvement. Perhaps, knowing what was coming, we might contrive to stay clear of the worst.
It's a very big place, Sassenach.
He looked out over the prow of the boat into the vast black sweep of invisible land.
Only since we left Georgia, we have travelled farther than the whole length of Scotland and England both.
That's true, I admitted. In Scotland, even among the high crags of the Highlands, there had been no way to escape the ravages of war. Not so here. Should we seek our place carefully, we might indeed escape the roving eye of Mars. He tilted his head to one side, smiling up at me.
I could see ye as a planter's lady, Sassenach. If the governor will find me a buyer for the other stones, then I shall have enough, I think, to send Lyra all the money I promised her, and still have enough over to buy a good place, one where we might prosper.
He took my right hand in his thumb gently stroking my silver wedding ring.
Perhaps one day I shall deck ye in laces and jewels, he said softly. I haven't been able to give you much, ever, save a wee silver ring and my mother's pearls.
You've given me a lot more than that, I said. I wrapped my fingers around his thumb and squeezed. Brianna, for one. He smiled faintly, looking down at the deck.
Aye, that's true. She's maybe the real reason for staying, I mean.
I pulled him toward me, and he rested his head against my knee.
"This is her place, no?"
he said quietly. He lifted a hand, gesturing toward the river, the trees, and the sky.
"She'll be born here. She'll live here."
"That's right," I said softly. I stroked his hair, smoothing the thick strands that were so much like Brianna's. "This will be her country. Hers, in a way, it could never be mine, or his, no matter how long we might live here." He nodded, beard rasping gently against my skirt.
"I dinna wish to fight, or have ye ever in danger, Sassenach. But if there is a bit I can do, to build, maybe, to make it safe and a good land for her."
He shrugged.
"It would please me," he finished softly.
We sat silently for a bit, close together, watching the dull shine of the water and the slow progress of the sunken lantern. "I left the pearls for her," I said at last. That seemed right. They were an heirloom, after all. I drew my ringed hand curved across his lips. "And the ring is all I need." He took both my hands in his then and kissed them. The left, which still bore the gold ring of my marriage to Frank, and then the right, with his own silver ring.
"Da mi basia mille," he whispered, smiling.
"Give me 1,000 kisses." It was the inscription inside my ring, a brief quotation from a love song by Catullus. I bent and gave him one back.
"De in mille altera," I said.
"Then 1,000 more." It was near midnight when we tied up near a brushy grove to rest. The weather had changed, still hot and muggy, Now the air held the hint of thunder, and the undergrowth stirred with small movements, random air currents, or the scurryings of tiny night things hastening for home before the storm. We were nearly at the end of the tidal surge. From here it would be a matter of sail and pole, and Captain Freeman had hopes of catching a good breeze on the wings of a storm. It would pay us to rest while we could. I curled into our nest on the stern, but was unable to fall asleep at once, late as it was. By the captain's estimation, we might make Cross Creek by evening tomorrow, certainly by the day after. I was surprised to realize how eagerly I was looking forward to our arrival. 2 months of living hand to mouth on the road had given me an urgent longing for some haven, no matter how temporary. Familiar as I was with Highland notions of hospitality and kinship, I had no fears regarding our welcome. Jamie plainly did not consider the fact that he hadn't met this particular aunt in 40-odd years to be any bar to our cordial reception, and I was quite sure he was right. At the same time, I couldn't help entertaining considerable curiosity about Jocasta Cameron. There had been 5 Mackenzie siblings, the children of old Red Jacob, who had built Castle Leoch. Jamie's mother, Ellen, had been the eldest, Jocasta, the youngest. Janet, the other sister, had died, like Ellen, well before I met Jamie, but I had known the 2 brothers, Colum and Dougal, quite well indeed, and from that knowledge couldn't help speculating as to what this last Mackenzie of Leoch might be like. Tall, I thought, with a glance at Jamie, curled up peacefully on the deck beside me. Tall, and maybe red-haired. They were all tall, even Colum, victim of a crippling degenerative disease, had been tall to begin with. Fair-skinned Vikings, the lot of them, with a ruddy blaze to their colouring that shimmered from Jamie's fiery red through his Uncle Dougal's deep russet. Only Colum had been truly dark. Remembering Colum and Dougal, I felt a sudden stir of unease. Colum had died before Culloden, killed by his disease. Dougal had died on the eve of the battle, killed by Jamie. It had been a matter of self-defence, myself, in fact, and only one of so many deaths in that bloody April. Still, I did wonder whether Jamie had given any thought as to what he might say when the greetings were passed at River Run and the casual family chat got round to, "Oh, and when did you last see so-and-so?" Jamie sighed and stretched in his sleep. He could, and did, sleep well on any surface, accustomed as he had been to sleeping in conditions that ranged from wet heather to musty caves, to the cold stone floors of prison cells. I suppose the wooden decking under us must be thoroughly comfortable by contrast. I was neither so elastic nor so hardened myself, but gradually weariness overwhelmed me, and even the prick of curiosity about the future was unable to keep me awake. I woke to confusion. It was still dark, and there was noise all around, shouting and barking, and the deck beneath me trembled with the vibration of stamping feet. I jerked upright, half thinking myself aboard a sailing ship, convinced that we had been boarded by pirates. Then my mind cleared, along with my foggy vision, and I discovered that we had been boarded by pirates. Strange voices shouted oaths and orders, and booted feet were heavy on the deck. Jamie was gone. I scrabbled onto my hands and feet, taking no heed for clothes or anything else. It was near dawn. The sky was dark, but light enough that the cabin showed as a darker blotch against it. As I struggled upright, clinging to the cabin roof for support, I was nearly knocked flat by flying bodies hurling themselves across it. There was a confused blur of fur and white faces, a shout and a shot and a terrible thud, and Ian was crouching ashen on the deck over Rollo's heaving form. A strange man, hatless and dishevelled, pushed himself to his feet. "Damn, he nearly got me." Unhinged by the near miss, the robber's hand trembled as he fumbled with a spare pistol at his belt. He pointed it at the dog, face drawing down in an ugly squint. "Take that, ass bite." A taller man appeared from nowhere, his hand knocking down the pistol before the flint could strike. "Don't waste the shot, fool." He gestured to Troclus and Captain Freeman, the latter volubly incensed, being herded toward me.
"How do you mean to hold them with an empty gun?"
The shorter man cast an evil look at Rollo, but swung his pistol to bear on Freeman's midriff instead. Rollo was making an odd noise, a low growling mixed with whimpers of pain, and I could see a wet, dark stain on the boards under his twitching body. Ian bent low over him, hand stroking his head helplessly. He looked up, and tears shone wet on his cheeks.
"Help me, Auntie," he said. "Please help."
I moved impulsively, and the tall man stepped forward, thrusting out an arm to stop me. "I want to help the dog," I said.
"What?" said the short robber in tones of outrage.
The tall man was masked. They all were, I realized, my eyes adjusting to the growing half-light. How many were there? It was impossible to tell under the mask, but I had the distinct impression that the tall man was smiling. He didn't answer, but gave a short jerk of his pistol, giving me leave.
"Hello, old boy," I said under my breath, dropping to my knees next to the dog. "Don't bite. He's a good doggie."
"Where is he hurt, Ian? Do you know?" Ian shook his head, sniffing back the tears.
"It's under him. I can't get him to turn over."
I wasn't about to try to heave the dog's huge carcass over either. I felt quickly for a pulse in the neck, but my fingers sank into Rollo's thick ruff, prodding uselessly. Seized by inspiration, I instead picked up a front leg and felt up its length, getting my fingers into the hollow where the leg met the body. Sure enough, there it was, a steady pulse throbbing reassuringly under my fingers. I began by habit to count, but quickly abandoned the effort as I had no idea what a dog's normal pulse rate should be. It was steady, though. No fluttering, no arrhythmia, no weakness. That was a very good sign. Another was that Rollo hadn't lost consciousness. The great leg I held tucked under my elbow had the tension of coiled spring, not the limp dangle of shock. The dog made a long, high-pitched noise, halfway between a whine and a howl, and began to scrabble with his claws, pulling his leg out of my grasp in an effort to right himself.
"I don't think it's very bad, Ian," I said in relief. "Look, he's turning over."
Rollo stood up, swaying. He shook his head violently, shaggy coat twitching from head to tail, and a shower of blood drops flew over the deck with a sound like pattering rain. The big yellow eyes fixed on the short man with a look that was clear to the meanest intelligence.
"Here, you stop him, or I swear I'll shoot him dead."
Panic and sincerity rang out in the robber's voice as the muzzle of the pistol drifted uncertainly between the little group of prisoners and Rollo's lip-curled snarl. Ian, who had been frantically undoing his shirt, whipped the garment off and over Rollo's head, temporarily blinding the dog, who shook his head madly, making growling noises inside the restraint. Blood stained the yellow linen. I could see now, though, that it came from a shallow gash in the dog's shoulder. Evidently the bullet had only grazed him. Ian hung on grimly, forcing Rollo back on his haunches, muttering orders to the dog's swaddled head.
"How many aboard?"
The taller man's sharp eyes flicked toward Captain Freeman, whose mouth was pressed so tightly together it looked no more than a purse seam in the grey fur of his face. Then toward me. I knew him, knew the voice. The knowledge must have shown in my face, for he paused for a moment, then jerked his head and let the masking kerchief fall from his face.
"How many?"
Stephen Bonnet asked again.
"Six," I said.
There was no reason not to answer. I could see Fergus on the shore, hands raised as a third pirate herded him at gunpoint toward the boat. Jamie had materialized out of the darkness beside me, looking grim.
"Mr. Fraser," Bonnet said pleasantly at the sight of him, "a pleasure to be renewing our acquaintance. But did you not have another companion, sir? The one-armed gentleman?"
"Not here,"
Jamie replied shortly.
"I'll have a look,"
the short robber muttered, turning, but Bonnet stopped him with a gesture.
"Ah, no, and would you be doubting the word of a gentleman like Mr. Fraser? No,
You'll be after guarding these fine folk here, Roberts. I'll be having the look around.
With a nod to his companion, he vanished. Looking after Rollo had distracted me momentarily from the commotion going on elsewhere on the boat. Sounds of breakage came from inside the cabin, and I leapt to my feet, reminded of my medicine box.
"Here, where are you going? Stop, I'll shoot!"
The robber's voice held a desperate note, but an uncertain one as well. I didn't stop to look at him, but dived into the cabin, cannoning into a fourth robber, who was indeed rummaging through my medicine chest. I staggered back from the collision, then clutched his arm with a cry of outrage. He had been carelessly opening boxes and bottles, shaking out the contents and tossing them on the floor. A litter of bottles, many of them broken, lay amid the scattered remnants of Dr. Rawlings' selections of medicines.
"Don't you dare touch those," I said,
and snatching the nearest vial from the chest, I popped out the cork and flung the contents in his face. Like most of Rawlings' mixtures, it contained a high proportion of alcohol. He gasped as the liquid hit and reeled backward, eyes streaming. I pressed my advantage by seizing a stone ale bottle from the wreckage and hitting him on the head with it. It hit with a satisfying thunk, but I hadn't hit him quite hard enough. He staggered but stayed upright, lurching as he grabbed at me. I drew back my arm for another swing, but my wrist was seized from behind by a grip like iron.
"Begging your pardon, Mrs. Fraser, dear," said a polite, familiar Irish voice, "but I really cannot allow you to crack his head. It's not very ornamental, sure, but he needs it to hold up his hat." "Friggin' bitch! She hit me!"
The man I had hit was clutching his head, his features screwed up in pain. Bonnet hauled me out onto the deck, my arm twisted painfully behind my back. It was nearly light by now. The river glowed like flat silver. I stared hard at our assailants. I meant to know them again if I saw them, masks or no masks. Unfortunately, the improved light allowed the robbers better vision as well. The man I had hit, who seemed to be bearing a distinct grudge, seized my hand and wrenched at my ring.
"Here, let's have that."
I yanked my hand away and made to slap him, but was stopped by a meaningful cough from Bonnet, who had stepped close to Ian and was holding his pistol an inch from the boy's left ear.
"Best hand them over, Mrs. Fraser," he said politely. "I fear Mr. Roberts requires some compensation for the damage you've caused him."
I twisted my gold ring off, hands trembling both with fear and rage. The silver one was harder. It stuck on my knuckle as though reluctant to part from me. Both rings were damp and slippery with sweat, the metal warmer than my suddenly chilled fingers.
"Give 'em up."
The man poked me roughly in the shoulder, then turned up a broad, grubby palm for the rings. I reached toward him, reluctantly, rings cupped in my hand, and then, with an impulse I didn't stop to examine, clapped my hand to my mouth instead. My head hit the cabin wall with a thud as the man knocked me backwards. His calloused fingers jabbed my cheeks and poked into my mouth, probing roughly in search of the rings. I twisted and gulped hard, mouth filling with saliva and a silver taste that might have been either metal or blood. I bit down, and he jerked back with a cry. One ring must have flown out of my mouth, for I heard a faint metallic ping somewhere, and then I gagged and choked, the second ring sliding into my gullet, hard and round.
"Bitch! Slit your friggin' throat. You'll go to hell without your rings, you cheating whore."
I saw the man's face contorted in rage and the sudden glitter of a knife blade drawn. Then something hit me hard and knocked me over, and I found myself crushed to the deck, flattened under Jamie's body. I was too stunned to move, though I couldn't have moved in any case. Jamie's chest was pressing on the back of my head, squashing my face into the deck. There was a lot of shouting and confusion, muffled by the folds of damp linen around my head. There was a soft thunk, and I felt Jamie jerk and grunt. "Oh, God, they've stabbed him," I thought, in an agony of terror. Another thump, and a louder grunt, though, indicated only a kick in the ribs. Jamie didn't move, just pressed himself harder against the deck, flattening me like the filling of a sandwich.
"Leave off, Roberts. I said leave him."
Bonnet's voice rang out in tones of authority sharp enough to penetrate the muffling cloth.
"But she..."
Roberts began. But his querulous whine was stopped abruptly with a sharp, meaty smack.
"Raise yourself, Mr. Fraser. Your wife is safe, not that she deserves to be."
Bonnet's husky baritone held mingled tones of amusement and irritation. Jamie's wake lifted slowly off me, and I sat up, feeling dizzy and mildly sick from the blow on the head. Stephen Bonnet stood looking down at me, examining me with faint distaste, as though I were a mangy deer-hide he'd been offered for sale. Next to him, Roberts glared malevolently, dabbing at a smear of blood at his hairline. Bonnet blinked finally, and switched his gaze to Jamie, who had regained his feet.
"A foolish woman," Bonnet said dispassionately, "but I suppose you don't mind that."
He nodded, a faint smile showing.
"I'm obliged for the opportunity to repay me debt to you, sir. A life for a life, as the good book says." "Repay us?" Ian said angrily. "After what we've done for you, you'll rob and spoil us, lay violent hands upon my aunt and my dog, and then you'll have a gall to speak of repayment."
Bonnet's pale eyes fixed on Ian's face. They were green, the colour of peeled grapes. He had a deep dimple in one cheek, as though God had pressed a thumb there in his making, but the eyes were as cold as river water at dawn.
"Why, were you never after learning your scripture, lad?"
Bonnet shook his head reprovingly with a click of the tongue.
"A virtuous woman is prized above rubies. Her price is greater than pearls."
He opened his hand, still smiling, and the lantern light glittered off three gems, emerald, sapphire, and the dark fire of a black diamond.
"I'm sure Mr. Fraser would agree, would you not, sir?"
He slipped the hand into his coat, then brought it out empty.
"And after all," he said,
cold eyes swivelling once more toward Ian,
"there are repayments of different kinds."
He smiled, not very pleasantly.
"Though I should not suppose you can be old enough to know that yet. Be glad I've no mind to give you a lesson."
He turned away, beckoning to his comrades.
"We have what we came for," he said abruptly. "Come."
He stepped up onto the rail and jumped, landing with a grunt on the muddy river bank. His henchmen followed, Roberts casting an evil look at me before splashing awkwardly into the shallows and ashore. The four men disappeared at once into the brush, and I heard the high-pitched greeting whinny of a horse somewhere in the darkness. Aboard, all was silence. The sky was the colour of charcoal, and thunder grumbled faintly in the distance, sheet lightning flickering just above the far horizon.
"Bastards!"
Captain Freeman spat in valediction over the side and turned to his mate.
"Fetch the poles, you truckless," he said,
and shambled toward the tiller, hitching his breeks upward as he went. Slowly, the others stirred and came to life. Fergus, with a glance at Jamie, lit the lantern, and then disappeared into the cabin, where I heard him beginning to set things to right. Ian sat huddled on the deck, his dark head bent over Rollo as he dabbed at the dog's neck with his wadded shirt. I didn't want to look at Jamie. I rolled onto my hands and knees and crawled slowly over to young Ian. Rollo watched me, yellow eyes wary, but made no objection to my presence.
"How is he?"
I said, rather hoarsely. I could feel the ring in my throat, an uncomfortable obstruction, and swallowed heavily several times. Young Ian looked up at once. His face was white and set, but his eyes were alert.
"He's all right, I think," he said softly. "Auntie, are you all right? You're no hurt, are you?"
"No," I said, and tried to smile reassuringly. "I'm fine." There was a sore spot on the back of my skull, and my ears still rang slightly. The yellow halo of light around the lantern seemed to oscillate, to swell and shrink in rhythm with the beating of my heart. One cheek was scraped. I had a bruised elbow and a large splinter in one hand, but I seemed to be fundamentally sound physically. Otherwise, I had my doubts. I didn't look around at Jamie, some 6 feet behind me, but I could feel his presence, ominous as a thundercloud. Ian, who plainly could see him over my shoulder, looked faintly apprehensive. There was a slight creaking of the deck, and Ian's expression eased. I heard Jamie's voice inside the cabin, outwardly casual as he asked Fergus a question. Then it faded, lost in the sounds of bumping and shuffling as the men righted furniture and repiled the scattered goods. I let my breath out slowly.
"Dunna fash, auntie,"
Ian said, in an attempt at comfort. "Uncle Jamie's no the sort to lay hands on ye, I dinna think." I wasn't at all sure of that, given the vibrations coming from Jamie's direction, but I hoped he was right. "Is he terribly angry, do you think?" I asked in a low voice. Ian shrugged uneasily.
"Well, last time I saw him look at me that way, he took me back of the house and knocked me flat. He wouldn't have served you that way, though, I'm sure," he added hastily.
"I don't suppose so," I said, a little bleakly. I wasn't sure I wouldn't prefer it if he did.
"It's no very nice to get the rough side of Uncle Jamie's tongue either," Ian said, shaking his head sympathetically. "I'd rather a thrashing myself."
I gave Ian a quelling look and leaned over the dog. "Sufficient to the day is the evil thereof." Has the bleeding stopped? It had. Disregarding the blood-matted fur, there was surprisingly little damage, no more than a deep nick in the skin and muscle near the shoulder. Rollo flattened his ears and showed his teeth as I examined him, but made no audible protest.
"Good dog," I murmured.
Had I any way to numb the skin, I would have stitched the wound, but we would have to do without such niceties.
"He should have a little ointment there to keep the flies out." "I'll get it, auntie. I ken where your wee box is."
Ian gently edged Rollo's nose off his knee and got to his feet.
"It'll be the green stuff you put on Fergus's too."
At my nod, he disappeared into the cabin, leaving me to deal with my quivering stomach, sore head, and congested throat. I swallowed several times, but with no great result. I touched my throat gingerly, wondering which ring I still had. Eutroclus came round the corner of the cabin, carrying a long, thick pole of white wood, deeply stained at one end, the marks testifying to the frequent necessity of its use. Stabbing the pole firmly down off the side, he leaned his weight against it, heaving with a long, sustained effort. I jumped as Jamie came out of the shadows, a similar pole in his hand. I hadn't heard him above the miscellaneous thumpings and shouts. He didn't look at me, but shed his shirt, and at the deckhand's indication, stabbed down his pole. On the fourth try, I felt the vibration of the hull, a small judder as something shifted. Encouraged, Jamie and the hand shoved harder, and all of a sudden the hull slid free with a muted whong of resonant wood that made Rollo lift his head with a startled woof. Eutroclus nodded to Jamie, face beaming under a shiny layer of sweat, and took the pole from him. Jamie nodded back, smiling, and picking up his shirt from the deck, turned toward me. I stiffened, and Rollo twitched his ears to full alert. But Jamie showed no immediate disposition either to berate me or to toss me overboard. Instead, he leaned down, frowning as he peered at me in the wavering lantern light.
"How do you feel, Sassenach? I cannot tell if you're really green, or is it only the light?"
"I'm all right. A bit shaky, perhaps." More than a bit. My hands were still clammy, and I knew my trembling knees wouldn't hold me if I tried to stand. I swallowed hard, coughed, and thumped myself on the chest. "It's probably my imagination, but it feels like the ring is caught in my throat." He squinted thoughtfully at me, then turned to Fergus, who had appeared from the cabin and was hovering nearby.
"Ask the captain, might I see his pipe for a moment, Fergus?"
He turned away, pulling his shirt over his head, and disappeared aft himself, returning moments later with a cup of water. I reached gratefully for it, but he held it out of my reach.
"Not just yet, Sassenach," he said. "Got it? Aye, thanks, Fergus. Fetch an empty bucket now, will you?"
Taking the filthy pipe from a puzzled Fergus, he inserted his thumb into the stained bowl and began to scrape at the burnt, gummy residue that lined it. Turning the pipe upside down, he tapped it over the cup of water, causing a small shower of brown crusts and moist crumbs of half-burnt tobacco, which he stirred into the water with his blackened thumb. Finished with these preparations, he looked up at me over the rim of the cup in a distinctly sinister fashion.
"No,"
I said. "Oh, no."
"Oh, yes," he said.
"Come on, Sassenach. It'll cure what ails you."
"I'll just wait," I said. I folded my arms across my chest. "Thanks, anyway." Fergus had by this time reappeared with the bucket, eyebrows raised high. Jamie took it from him and plunked it on the deck next to me.
"I've done it that way, Sassenach," he informed me, "and it's a good deal messier than you might think. It's also not a pleasant thing to do on a boat in close company, aye?"
He put a hand on the back of my head and pressed the cup against my lower lip.
"This will be quick. Come on now, a wee sip is all."
I pressed my lips tightly together. The smell from the cup was enough to make my stomach turn over, combining as it did the stale reek of tobacco. The sight of the noisome brown surface of the liquid, crusts swimming below the surface, and the memory of Captain Freeman's blobs of brown-tinged spittle sliding down the deck. Jamie didn't bother with argument or persuasion. He simply let go of my head, pinched my nose shut, and when I opened my mouth to breathe, tipped in the foul-smelling contents of the cup.
"Oof!" "Swallow," he said,
clapping a hand tightly across my mouth and ignoring both my frenzied squirming and the muffled sounds of protest I was making. He was a lot stronger than I was, and he didn't mean to let go. It was swallow or strangle.
I swallowed. "Good as new."
Jamie finished polishing the silver ring on his shirt tail and held it up, admiring it in the glow of the lantern.
"That is something better than can be said of me," I replied coldly.
I lay in a crumpled heap on the deck, which, in spite of the placid current, seemed still to be heaving very slightly under me.
"You are a grade A, double-dyed, sadistic fucking bastard, Jamie Fraser."
He bent over me and smoothed the damp hair off my face.
"I expect so. If you feel well enough to call me name, Sassenach, you'll do. Rest a bit, aye?"
He kissed me gently on the forehead and sat back. Excitement over and order restored to the ravaged decks, the other men had gone back to the cabin to restore themselves with the aid of a bottle of applejack that Captain Freeman had contrived to save from the pirates by dropping it into the water barrel. A small cup of this beverage rested on the deck near my head. I was still too queasy to countenance swallowing anything, but the warm, fruity smell was mildly comforting. We were under sail. Everyone was eager to get away, as though some danger still lingered over the place of the attack. We were moving faster now. The usual small cloud of insects that hovered near the lanterns had dispersed, reduced to no more than a few lace wings resting on the beam above, their delicate green bodies causing tiny streaks of shadow. Inside the cabin, there was a small burst of laughter and an answering growl from Rollo on the side deck. Things were returning to normal. A small welcome breeze played across the deck, evaporating the clammy sweat on my face and lifting the ends of Jamie's hair, drifting them across his face. I could see the small vertical line between his brows and the tilt of his head that indicated deep thought. Little wonder if he was thinking. In one stroke, we had gone from riches, potential riches at least, to rags. Our well-equipped expedition reduced to a sack of beans and a used medicine chest. So much for his desire not to appear as beggars at Jocasta Cameron's door. We were little more than that now. My throat ached for him, pity replacing irritation. Beyond the question of his immediate pride, there was now a terrifying void in that unknown territory marked the future. The future had been well open to question before, but the sharp edges of all such questions had been buffered by the comforting knowledge that we would have money to help accomplish our aims, whatever those turned out to be. Even our penurious trip north had felt like an adventure, with the certain knowledge that we possessed a fortune, whether it was spendable or not. I had never before considered myself a person who placed much value on money, but having the certainty of security ripped away in this violent fashion had given me a sudden and quite unexpected attack of vertigo, as though I were falling down a long, dark well, powerless to stop. What had it done to Jamie, who felt not only his danger and mine, but the crushing responsibility of so many other lives? Ian, Fergus, Massali, Duncan, the inhabitants of Lallybroch, even that bloody nuisance Lyra. I wasn't sure whether to laugh or cry, thinking of the money Jamie had sent her. The vengeful creature was a good deal better off at present than we were. At the thought of vengeance, I felt a new stab that displaced all lesser fears. While Jamie wasn't markedly vengeful, for a Scot, no Highlander would suffer a loss such as this with silent resignation. A loss not only of fortune, but of honour. What might he feel compelled to do about it? Jamie stared fixedly into the dark water. His mouth was set. Was he seeing once again the graveyard where, swayed by Duncan's intoxicated sentimentality, he had agreed to help Bonnet escape? It belatedly occurred to me that the financial aspects of the disaster likely hadn't yet entered Jamie's mind. He was occupied in more bitter reflection. It was he who had helped Bonnet escape the hangman's rope and set him free to prey on the innocent. How many besides us would suffer because of that? "You're not to blame," I said, touching his knee. "Who else?" he said quietly, not looking at me. "I kent the man for what he was. I could have left him to the fate he'd earned, but I did not. I was a fool."
"You were kind. It's not the same thing."
"Near enough."
He breathed in deeply. The air was freshening with the scent of ozone. The rain was near. He reached for the cup of applejack and drank, then looked at me for the first time, holding up the cup inquiringly. "Yes, thanks." I struggled to sit up, but Jamie took me by the shoulders and lifted me to lean against him. He held the cup for me to drink, the blood-warm liquid sliding soft across my tongue. Then taking fire as it slid down my throat, burning away the traces of sickness and tobacco, leaving in their place rum's lingering taste of burning sugarcane.
"Better."
I nodded and held up my right hand. He slid the ring onto my finger, the metal warm from his hand. Then, folding down my fingers, he squeezed my fist hard in his own and held it tight. Had he been following us since Charleston? I wondered aloud. Jamie shook his head. His hair was still loose, heavy waves falling forward to hide his face.
"I dinna think so. If he'd kent we'd had the jewels, he would have set upon us on the road before we reached Wilmington. No, I expect he learned it from one of Lillington's servants. I thought we'd be safe enough, for we'd be away to Cross Creek before anyone heard of the gems. Someone talked, though. A footman. Perhaps the sempstress who sewed your gown."
His face was outwardly calm, but it always was when he was hiding strong emotions. A sudden gust of hot wind shot sideways across the deck. The rain was getting closer. It whipped the loose ends of his hair across his cheek, and he wiped them back, running his fingers through the thick mass.
"I'm sorry for your other ring," he said, after a moment.
"Oh, it's..." I started to say. "It's all right." But the words stuck in my throat, choked by the sudden realization of loss. I had worn that gold ring for nearly 30 years, token of vows taken, forsaken, renewed, and at last absolved. A token of marriage, of family, of a large part of my life, and the last trace of Frank, whom, in spite of everything, I had loved. Jamie didn't say anything, but he took my left hand in his own and held it, lightly stroking my knuckles with his thumb. I didn't speak either. I sighed deeply and turned my face toward the stern. The trees along the shore were shivering in a rising wind of anticipation, leaves rustling loudly enough to drown the sound of the vessel's passage. A small drop struck my cheek, but I didn't move. My hand lay limp and white in his, looking unaccustomedly frail. It was something of a shock to see it that way. I was used to paying a great deal of attention to my hands, one way and another. They were my tools, my channel of touch, mingling the delicacy and strength by which I